You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And it's community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And we'll bring up a little song here, and then we'll get started with our guest here in a moment. If I get it. And my guest tonight is Vicki Davis, and she has been on the program a couple of other times in the past, and has been she's a great researcher, and has a website called Channeling Reality. I believe it's channelingreality.com, www.channelingreality.com. Vicki, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Melody. Hi. It's good to be back. I think this is my third time. Isn't it?
But we also did you co-hosted with me one night, too. So
that's true, I did. Yeah. For the audience tonight, I guess I should probably introduce myself since I forgot to send you the a little bio.
And I was looking for one, and I'm going, I wonder if she really likes to talk about herself. I don't know.
Well, not all that much, but I was a computer systems analyst programmer for 20 years, working primarily for large corporations, doing business systems. And after around 2000, suddenly the market for my skills dried up. And in the course of researching, you know, trying to figure out what's going on, I discovered outsourcing. And so I thought, well, that, you know, that's a real problem, you know, sending computer systems across the ocean over to India and importing Indians to work here. So that's when I really started researching to figure out what was going on, that our national security would be breached like that, which is what I consider that it is. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
And so kind of what we were going to hit on tonight was one of your articles that you'd written on your website. It's called War in the Context of Everything Else. You even have a little bit of an acronym there with it.
Yeah, Wiki. Yeah, I got tired of writing out the whole thing, so I made an acronym. So we can call it the Wiki War.
But when you were talking about what happened to you, it didn't happen by accident, did it? I mean, this is something that's been kind of in the making for quite a long time.
Oh, it was very much intentional. When they signed the Uruguay round of the trade agreements, they included trade-in services. And a service is any job that is performed by a person, as well as service businesses, banking, insurance, anything that's information oriented or that is a job or a service provided by a person. Okay, so it could be a street sweeper provides a service, a surgeon provides a service, you know, so you've got the spectrum there covered, you know, between those two kinds of jobs.
But when it comes about, when they defined that, was that a kind of a change in its usage or definition?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it a change in definition. When they started, well, there were three firms that started negotiations to include services in trade agreements. Now, prior to that time, the items that had been included in trade agreements were products and commodities, the normal kinds of things that you think of when you think of trade. But AIG, American Express, and Citibank formed a little lobbying group, and they made a concerted effort to get services included in the trade agreement. And by the inclusion of services, they specifically included people as tradable commodities, human tradable commodities, in the trade agreements.
And that, like you said, that hadn't been done in the past.
No, not at all.
Okay. And when did this take place?
This was it began actually in the negotiations for it began in the early 80s, and when Reagan was in office, and one of Reagan's initiatives was a free trade area of the Americas from Argentina clear up through Alaska. And that's when they really began this whole agenda of what they call free trade, which is actually not about trade at all. What they call free trade agreements are actually multinational investment agreements. And what they call for, what they agreed to, is for the multinational corporations to be able to move their production to a foreign country, to do business in a foreign country, and then re-import back into this country with no tariff penalty. So, but it was sold with this very attractive and who can argue with it label of free trade. So okay. it really was fraudulent.
Okay, so in order to kind of bring this into the context of, you know, the war in the context of everything else, is what you're really talking about here is utilizing a system that is dismantling this country from the inside economically and on numerous other avenues, correct?
Yes. Yes. War in the context of everything else is asymmetric warfare. It's stealth warfare, coming at you with everything but bullets. You know, they, I've documented in this paper that I wrote, I documented many of the ways that they basically declared war on the middle class of this country, and the free trade and the free trade was an attack on our economy, and it was an attack at the middle, because it was the middle class that basically had these the majority of information jobs, you know, that were included in the trade agreements. But prior to that, they had already exported a lot of our manufacturing processes. But when they started signing these free trade agreements, the Congress made it so, it's actually the U.S. Trade Representative's office that negotiates the agreements. And then the Senate just does an up or down vote on them. They made it so attractive for corporations to move out of this country that's what they've done. And most of the large corporations that you see, they're basically facades now. All they are is sales and import offices.
Well, they also made it to where those that didn't want to go out couldn't compete with them.
Right, because if a manufacturer moves to China, for example, he's gone from paying an American worker that, you know, an average American worker that had been with the factory for 10 years or more, he's being paid maybe $20 an hour for that job. The manufacturer that moves over to China is paying 50 cents an hour for the same labor. And if he can re-import then back into this country with no penalty, then, you know, it's a no-brainer in terms of a corporate decision. What do you do? Well, your job as a corporate manager, director, is to maximize profits. So you move your corporation over to China and then re-import back in, and now your competitors are still paying $20 an hour compared to your 50 cent an hour labor. And so, you know, yeah, they can't compete.
You know,
there's no way to compete.
There's so many different angles I could look at this, but when you start out with on the first part of your article with Sun Tzu, and who is the book The Art of War was the character, and I was reading something just recently from a marketing representative, and I can't remember what he was marketing at the time, but he was quoting Sun Tzu as well. And in other words, he was viewing in the context that he was using that word, his model, as though the public was an enemy. And it was really interesting to see how we're being, made out to be, enemies, or we're being pitted against each other, being pitted against other people, and just to be able to survive. And we have to. And another aspect that you get into this article is talking about the wording, and you might want to get into that a little bit too. I mean, you can discuss a little bit of why you picked Sun Tzu, and then the wording of how it has been changed and or have a double meaning.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sun Tzu, he, I think, is the undisputed master of war by stealth. It's rather than using brute force in warfare, his idea was intellectual warfare. How can I come at my enemy in such a way that my enemy doesn't even know that I'm coming? And may not figure out that he's even in a war until you're well into it. And that was why I wrote at the beginning of this, and I'll just read it for the audience. I know it's not good to read on radio, but
I don't know. It's just fine to me.
Okay. When somebody is shooting at you, there is no doubt in your mind that your life is at risk, so you take cover, and hopefully you have the means to shoot back. In a war, in the context of everything else, the enemy can come at you from all directions in ways limited only by the imagination of the enemy. And because of that, you don't know who they are or how they're coming, and the war is well underway before you even realize there is one. So fighting back requires that you meet the enemy on the battlefield of the mind before you can formulate a response strategy. And so really that's basically what I have been doing for the last 7 years or so, is trying to identify the enemy, the ways that they're coming at us, how they're coming at us, and hopefully so that we can formulate strategies to counter what they're doing and what they've done.
Well, and kind of I guess before you get too far into that, why would you think, why would they want to do that, and why are we having to deal with that here? What is the background behind, why would we even be considering or looking at why this is taking place in this country?
Well, I can only guess. I mean, when you understand the amount of money, I mean, look at the amount of money that's been taken out of our economy. In 2004, Treasury Secretary John Snow gave a speech to the National Press Club, and in that speech he said that between the dot-com bubble burst and the 9/11 and, the things that happened early in 2000, they took $7 trillion out of our economy. He said that the equities market collapsed. And to me, that means that the stock market crashed. But it was never really reported that way. The media just kept hyping the message, the economy is booming, the economy is booming. And that was one of the clues to me that we were having a war by stealth, because in the local newspapers, see, I was in a group of other programmers who had been disenfranchised cast out like yesterday's trash also. And so there were a group of us, and you know, we were sharing information, all trying to figure out what was going on. And in the local news for cities, there would be articles like a Walmart opened and 8,000 people would apply for a Walmart job. And or 11,000 people in Oakland, California applying for a Walmart job. The statistics, there were record bankruptcies, record foreclosures, and all the time the mainstream media is reporting the economy is booming. And they would quote housing starts and, you know, all of this stuff. Well, you know, that is a total contradiction. You can't have one part of the economy or you know, one part saying it's all, everything is great, everything is wonderful, but then you have all this really terrible news that's not being covered at all. And so just that disparity in storylines was enough to let me know there's something really terribly wrong going on in the country.
Well, you're familiar with, you know, the Rio Summit and Maurice Strong, is his involvement with that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
And in one of his statements in that summit, now it's just kind of paraphrasing it here, but it was to the effect that he was going after the middle class and was going to, instead of bringing the third world up to our standards, their aim was to bring us down to their standards. And in order to do that, they had to start dismantling a lot of things. And so some of this, in some of the documents that I've received from Bernie Smith, or I think I got that right, Bernadine Smith, I'm there, and she had sent me probably a 2-inch pile of documents going back into the 30s, 40s, 50s, talking about how they were going to dismantle this country and bring it into a different form of government. And one of the interesting things when I was looking up revolution, the term revolution tonight, because something made me want to look it up, and it gets into this thing about change. And so there, right there, goes back into that neurolingual programming or the changing of the meanings or doublespeak. And there again, I get back into the question I had for you before on how they change those terms to speak to two different levels of people, maybe?
Yes, and they use that all the time. It's a technique for free trade is an excellent example of it, because just the words free trade, it makes you think that it's something very attractive and very good, and of course, you know, who would argue against free trade? But when you understand what the underlying agreements are, then you can understand what the fraud of the label. It's not free trade at all. Those are multinational investment agreements, and they're not written in the favor of the United States. They're written against the interests of the United States, because as you just said, you know, Maurice Strong basically was talking about redistribution of wealth, taking away from us and giving away to the undeveloped countries to more or less equalize the standard of living at the bottom.
But that's the illusion that he purports, because that's the real interesting part about watching these different meetings when the Millennium Conference, I'm not sure the name of it now, but and then you have your various Davos and various things of that sort, and when you start listening to how they speak, these guys, when they talk about redistributing wealth, it's not distributing it to the poor. They make it sound like they're redistributing it to the poor, but it's really about distributing the wealth back to the wealth, those that already have a lot of money.
That's exactly right, because the whole idea of the global trading system was to redistribute the wealth, redistribute development. I mean, this is the way it was sold, to raise people out of poverty in countries like Africa and India and China and so forth. It's been just a dismal failure if that was their true goal, because poverty around the world has been increasing. And all the while, you know, the few people at the top, the maybe 10,000 or so, 20,000 people at the top of the global pyramid, their wealth has increased exponentially. And so, and there is no talk of correcting that imbalance, you know, just grossly out of proportion of income, you know, going to the CEOs and the major stockholders like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, those people. No talk of that. They're still talking about eliminating poverty for people on the bottom. So, I mean,
just like the term sustainability, when they're really saying the term sustainability, which is kind of an open-ended term, is sustainable for who? And that's the whole thing. They're really meaning sustainable for them and not sustainable for us.
Yeah, well, it can mean a whole bunch of things. And so if you're ever in a meeting where they're talking about sustainable development, you have to pin them down and ask them to define precisely what they mean. Because the term sustainable development doesn't mean anything. And there's a whole big body of thinking behind the concept of sustainable development. And if you wanted to sum it up as to what that is, it means reducing your standard of living, your use of resources, down to the most minimum possible. And they are implementing control systems like the smart grid and different control systems so that they can measure and monitor and manage your use of resources so that it is at an absolute minimum level, so that you don't get any more electricity than somebody in India. I mean, it's truly sociopathic. These people are sociopaths and psychopaths. And the deeper you go into it, the more you see it, the more you understand it, the more you have to say, oh my God, you know, where did these people come from?
Why don't you get into it? I mean, when we say this sort of thing, we have to come from their documentation. And I mean, because we're not just making this sort of stuff up. And this is where what I really enjoy about your work is you start digging into these meetings and these documents and listening to some of these programs that most people would just, you know, die of boredom over. But when you're really looking for certain information to be said and come through that, to understand what these guys are doing, you have to kind of sit there and go through these things, correct?
Yeah. Well, that's where my training as a systems analyst comes in really handy. I mean, it's almost tailor-made for a person that was in my career to be able to do this kind of research, because I like to listen to what people have to say about things. So I do watch all the hearings, and I go search out their documents, because that's what I'm doing, is I'm documenting. I don't write articles. I'm not a journalist. I'm a systems analyst. So I document the things that I find, and that's why all the links to everything that I say are to the original source material where I found it. And what I do is I put a narrative between the things that I find to enable you to develop a picture of what they're talking about and what it was that I saw when I was listening to them and reading the materials.
Okay, I'm looking here at a document that you have on your site from the Congressional Record and its Proceedings and Debates of the 83rd Congress, Second Session. And it's titled The Great Conspiracy to Destroy the United States. And it was a speech by the Honorable Usher L. Burdick of North Dakota. Why did you put that there?
Because it's what's been going on in our country has been going on for a very long time. And in the past, a person would have had to spend their life in a library and would never have been able, I mean, very few people would have been able to put together the whole picture. So when I find documents like that, or somebody sends them to me, and it is something where a person in the past knew what was happening, I like to include it on the website, and especially when it's a source like the Congressional Record, because that, of course, gives it tremendous credibility. And I'd bet anything if you could, you know, find information about that guy in the past, they would have been, he would have been called a nutcase, a conspiracy theorist, and everything he said would have been dismissed. But with the benefit of hindsight, you can read that document and you can see where we are today, and you can know that he knew what he was talking about. And it's a shame that that nobody was listening to him.
And this is where, you know, this is why it's so important with people like you that do, you know, get in and dig through these kind of documents, because, you know, I mean, I've been often referred to, you know, that very term, conspiracy person, but that's why I bring on people that are experts or are into research and do dig up these documents so that we, it can back up from where we're coming from. I'm not necessarily coming to my opinion or conclusion from thin air, and I'm hoping to at least direct people not to do the same. Don't take our word for it, but go do your own research. Start looking into these documents, because these, what's going on out there, these people are telling us what they're doing long in advance, and they do it very methodically. I mean, these people plan it years, 100 years, several hundred years in advance.
Yeah, and the evidence, if you were to read everything that's on my website that I've documented, you can find the threads of, you know, going through history that I have been following. And the trailheads that I always start with are the computer systems, because that was my business. And so one of the most significant things that was done that I documented in a piece called The Digital Fascism of the Dons of Davos has to do with basically the dismantling of our government and the redesign of our government systems to be integrated in a global system, a global information system. And back in 1990, the decision was made to internationalize our economy. And if you start at the G8 summits, you know, from 1990 and go forward, you'll see, you know, year by year, step by step, how the decisions that were made that led, that basically led us to the globalized economy. And in 1995, at the Brussels summit, they decided, the G8 decided to go with the concept of the global information society, and they defined 11 pilot projects for global systems. One of those systems was e-government or e-governance. Another one is global health. All this debate, you know, about the healthcare system that's going on now, what they're not telling you is that the changes that are included in the health reform legislation that they're talking about, that they want to implement, are for the global health system.
Well, you know, I found that interesting because one of the things that I received, because I have an insurance license, and I received a brochure from one of the companies that I've, you know, been licensed with for a number of years, and they were speaking of global insurance and one health and that sort of thing, and I'm going, boy, that's an interesting change in terminology. And I'm going, are these guys thinking and going to be able to now market their insurance all over the globe?
I would imagine so, yes. And that's what the whole deal is about, you know, getting changes to health insurance in this country, you know, because we have laws there is a state insurance commissioner that in each state. And the reason why they do that, because insurance is basically a protection racket when you get right down to it. And if they, the way that they make money, of course, is to not pay benefits. And to keep as much money of the premium dollars as they can. And so, and it has always been an industry that needs to be very closely and very tightly regulated. And so what the people that are promoting, or I don't even know how many of them really understand the fact that what they're talking about is a global health system. But the changes that they want to put in for insurance will be to allow the global health insurance market to be established for these large corporations to be able to do business across state lines without being regulated by each state that they do business in.
Yeah, and there's a lot of plans, too, that don't cover, you know, going in and out of the countries, or at least not in the same fashion, too. I mean, I'm sure there's got to be some positive aspects of it, or they wouldn't be able to market it in some respects. So
I've done quite a bit of research on the healthcare system because it, of course, has to do with an IT system, and the system of nationalized medical records is a part of it. But another part of it is telemedicine, which means that you might not be able to see a real doctor. What you might see is a nurse practitioner, and, you know, she might be connected to a doctor via the Internet. And, you know, there's a lot more to it than that, but, I mean, that's a basic idea. And already they are transmitting x-rays to various places around the world, and they might very well, you know, they're looking for the cheapest provider to read the x-rays, and they might find one in Zimbabwe. You don't know where your x-rays are going to be read. so of all the global systems, that one, the global health system, terrifies me, absolutely terrifies me.
Well, I actually went and had an eye exam today, and much of the system was done on computerized, and I know that that particular company has offices all over the state, and so I know it has to go through, you know, they should be able to, and they told me they can access it from any of the various offices. So, again, that I find a little ironic when you're, you know, they keep giving you these disclaimers about your records being private, and there's no way they could be private that way.
Yeah, there will be no more privacy. In Idaho, they established something called the Idaho Health Data Exchange, and I found them before they were even fully in business, and I requested that they send me an opt-out form, and I opted out. But the thing is, they're not telling everybody about it. You know, you've got to know about it to request the opt-out.
And what I'm kind of starting to hear from some of those that are paying attention in the medical arena, because I mean, it depends. One of the things that I really find is when somebody wants to hear something and they hear the same speech, that somebody doesn't want to hear something in that same speech, both can be satisfied in that one speech. And so there are those out there that think that this medical system is going to be a great thing, and there are those out there that hear that, you know, they're just going to be dismantling and outsourcing the medical profession far more than they have up to this point in time, and that we will, and what it appears that the you're, like you said, technicians and computer printouts will be more the norm than seeing them in person, and or you could be getting somebody from some other country doing your diagnosis, correct?
Yes. I'll tell you the people who are really happy about it. The hospital administrators, because it will allow them to eliminate the overhead of their medical records department, and DEA is real happy about it, because they'll be able to look and see, you know, how many doctors are you seeing, you know, to get your pain medications. So they know if you're a person who, I forget, there's a term that they use for people like that, that see multiple doctors so that they can get prescription drugs from, you know, the multiple doctors. And the insurance companies are happy about it, because they can look at your full medical history and say, oh, you know, here is a propensity for a particular disease. You may not have it, but, you know, your medical record contains just about every word that you say to a doctor, and it includes the doctor's notes. And so, you know, doctor might make a note saying, you know, we've got to watch that mole on the arm because it might turn into skin cancer. And the insurance company will look at that and say, oh, you know, might get skin cancer. We don't want to insure them. So, but, you know, that's why they're including in this, to make it attractive to people, they're including that you can't be turned down for pre-existing conditions. Well, big deal, you know, what they're going to do is to set up a high-risk pool, and you'll be charged insurance, you know, based on what it costs to be in this high-risk pool. which means you'll still be paying more than other people. So, and the whole idea of insurance anyway is to distribute the risk. You know, where you have a lot of people in the plan, you know, that most, the majority are basically healthy, and the idea is to, you know, spread the risk so that if you have one of those incidental occurrences of an unplanned accident or condition, that you won't have to bear the cost. The group bears the cost.
Now, where do you, okay, how would we tie this particular thing into this war in the context of everything?
Because it's part of the establishing control systems that will manage your life. You know, computer systems are management systems. They're control systems. And corporations, of course, use them to be able to control massive amounts of resources and people, and to minimize their costs and maximize their profits. And when they decided to redesign our government and go to an e-government model, they empowered these people, these systems analysts, and I can name a few of them, but I can't, of course, name all of them. But there is a design, there is a definite design to the systems that are being implemented and the way that they redesigned our government. And
that's, and in fact, one of the terms that, did it come out of Clinton and Gore when they started utilizing that terminology about the redefining government? Is that what I'm...
Yes, okay. Reinvention of government.
Reinvention of government.
And in the technical lingo, they came up with an enterprise architecture for the government of the United States. And the enterprise architecture is basically what you would say is a corporate structure for the government, for the administrative processes of government. And so all of these un-American things that are going on, you know, like Real ID and the fusion centers and the nationalized medical records, all of these things are tied into and a part of the enterprise architecture that is a corporate control system to manage the assets of the corporation.
Okay, and so when you're talking about corporation, isn't like the United States a corporation?
Well, yes, apparently there are corporation papers filed, I guess, but I personally don't know. I don't look at the government as a corporation.
There's something I read where there was something like 84,000 different incorporated government entities. And they may be listed on Dun & Bradstreet, but where I was going to go with that is the fact that the terminology, just human resource, tells you that it isn't just, that humans are considered a part of the assets of these corporations.
Well, and that's why, now, you know, it may be my own self-delusion, but I consider that there is a difference between government and a corporation. I'll grant you that the people that have taken over our government are corporatists, and what they've done is they've turned our government into a fascist, corporatist system. And under that system, yes, people are assets, they are resources, they are not citizens, they are entities of the corporate structure, and all of the systems are being designed to manage those assets.
Well, aren't you kind of saying that when you were mentioning the trade agreements, that, you know, that humans were to be added in there as a part of that, and so obviously they had it in mind?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's why I always, whenever I talk about trade in services, I always use the term human commodity, a human commodity for trade on the global market, because people really need to understand that aspect of the trading system, is that people, all of the, see, I don't really have a good background in Western civilization, but if you, all of the Western traditions of man and, you know, theories of mankind and civilization, all that goes out the window with this corporatist, fascist, totalitarian system. And people are just commodities. It's a return to a system of feudalism.
So I haven't seen too much in any of the ways of these isms working out to the benefit of most individuals, unless you have a significant background and money.
Yeah, well, that's true. The only true freedom is enough money. That's the only true freedom, to buy your way out of servitude.
Okay, now I'm looking right now at this Hague Peace Conference document that you've got posted on your website. The 1899 Hague Peace Conference, and you know, I've been following a little bit of this, these people that have been trying to set up a peace, a Department of Peace in this country, and I have a hard time getting on board of it, because of when I start looking at the history of these different things that are done in. These different things that are done in the form of trying to do it for the people, or for the good of humanity and whatever, and like the United Nations or the League of Nations were supposedly to help bring about international peace, and I haven't seen anything wane in the way of warfare since these things were supposedly started.
Right. Well, there isn't really a direct correlation between the 1899 Hague Peace. The reason why I have that in there is because it was around the turn of the century when the first international organizations actually got chartered and came into being. And the Hague Peace Conference was the conference that established the first international, formalized international organization. And there's a building over in Europe. I don't know if it's the Hague or the Palace of Justice. I forget which. But anyway, it was the first building that was built for an international institution. But the Department of Peace that you're talking about, and I think Dennis Kucinich is the one that actually proposed it, what that has, you see all these computer systems, these control systems via the Internet, telecommunications systems, they have in mind a plan, to implement these systems worldwide, so that everybody is linked up on the Internet and basically the internet will become the nerve center, the backbone of communications for the entire world. Well, in order to do that, of course, you know, they have to, the Middle Eastern countries and the African countries, the ones that are the very least developed, and those people don't want to be included in the global trading system, and for good reason. I, you know, just my personal opinion, I don't want to be included in the global trading system because it is a totalitarian system of control. So the people over in the Middle East are fighting it, the people over in Africa. In some ways, you know, they are much smarter than we are because I think they see it for what it is. And the people in this country, they're already so controlled, they don't, they and, you know, we have so many other things to deal with that we don't see it. But the people over in the least developed countries, they see it and they don't want it. And so the idea is that they're going to have to, you know, our military is going to have to go destroy their country and then rebuild it. And the systems administration for the global system would be in the Department of Peace, I think.
You know, the hardest part for me in looking, I mean, because I've sat on both sides of the fence here in arguments, and can sympathize and empathize in numerous aspects, and yet at the same time, it goes back to looking into their documents and where they really want to go, and I'm trying to think of, I don't know if you're familiar with Kissinger's document 200, but the ultimate thing is that what this is all funneling us in, and a little bit at a time, and sold to us with catchy phrases in terms of marketing, and you're seeing it done through the educational system through the media and every other aspect of our lives, and trying to figure out, you know, where this is all going. And then when you start seeing their documents, that they do have a place where they're going, they definitely have in mind that they want to put the world into one type of government all over the world.
Yes. A totalitarian system of control. And it's not hyperbole to say that they want a worker class that are basically drones. And they consider themselves above us, you know, and they basically want to rule the world like kings and queens. But, you know, when you're talking about computer systems, and when you've turned your government into a corporate structure, and everything is about maximum efficiency, well, efficiency, corporate level efficiency, dictates that there are an awful lot of people in this country that are useless eaters. And corporate efficiency demands that you get rid of that expense, because their cost is not their productivity is not equal to or greater than the cost to maintain them. You can think of it as a herd of animals, a herd of cattle, you know, or a herd of dairy cows. If you've got a herd of dairy cows and you're looking at the age of those dairy cows and the productivity of how much milk do they produce, and how much does it cost to feed them? And you're establishing a corporate efficiency. Well, you might have some old cows in there that they just don't produce as much milk as they did when they're young. And so they don't produce enough milk to justify the feed, and so you send them off to the glue factory because your whole total focus is on efficiency.
Is that a term? Do they use the term economy of scale for that? Have you heard that term?
Economy of scale, as I've heard it used most often, has to do with the size of a corporation and its ability to purchase, to do purchasing and get the best, absolute best possible price because of the volume that you're able to purchase.
So, but wouldn't economy of scale be kind of, couldn't be used in that same term? If a person is no longer productive, then they're not economically viable for the cost to the those that have to take care of them.
I don't really think so.
Okay.
Only if you would, you know, twist it or redefine the meaning of the term.
Okay, well, let me...
If you've heard it used in that way, it's probably that they did redefine the term. It's like Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan redefined the word inflation. You know, in traditionally, inflation meant a rise in price. And so you would have inflation when there was too much money chasing too few goods, and that caused the price to go up. He redefined, in building this global economy, they basically reversed the books. They reversed the economic thinking. And he redefined inflation to mean a rise in workers' wages rather than a rise in prices. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I suspect that the reason why they did that is because they changed the paradigm of the economy to supply side, meaning they exported the productive capacity of this country and they started importing goods into the country.
Okay, I need to go do a station ID, and you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. We're community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm visiting with Vicki Davis, and we're kind of going into the war in the context of everything else. And I guess we've kind of got off a little bit here as to how this is all warfare.
Well, it's warfare when they... Okay, let me finish with the inflation example, because...
Okay.
The way it was characterized is that Greenspan was waging war on the American middle class, because as you import goods and services into the country, and the domestic producers are trying to compete with a cheaper imported product, what does that do? It causes the employers that are still domestically engaged, it causes them to drop the price of wages, right?
Right.
So, I mean, that is a war by stealth on the middle class to drive down wages, which meets the goal of trying to equalize standards of living around the world. But it's trying to equalize those standards of living at the bottom. It's trying to push us down to the bottom rather than raising the other people up.
That was one of the things that I was thought was interesting, and maybe it was just my perception or perspective on it, was when the fact that when they did go over to these other countries and they were using slave labor and that sort, that, you know, there were some items that went down in price, but there were some items that, particularly along the clothing lines, that I was surprised really didn't reflect that difference.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. They didn't. I mean, the whole idea supposedly was to be able to offer us cheaper goods, but there was no requirement, of course, that a supplier lower their prices just because their cost of production goes down. It just increases their profit margins, and so that's why you see CEO rates of pay have skyrocketed. CEOs and key men, because there's the difference in price between producing in the United States and producing in a third world country, you know, whether it's Indonesia or China or, you know, somewhere like that. What they did is they just pocketed the difference in the cost of production, and that was substantial, and that's why you have so much propaganda saying free trade is good, free trade is good, you know, because it's good for them, and it's been good for the politicians that voted for it because they get big campaign contributions.
And the irony, at some of it, they really love to put these prima donna ads and articles in various magazines about these guys that would run these fund companies and that sort of thing. And it wasn't just them. It was a lot of different entrepreneurs or corporate heads of that sort. Like, they were these wonderful people. And now that I have started doing research into some of the backgrounds of some of these people, they were no prima donnas.
Well, I mean, it was a no-brainer. What they did with those hedge funds, it was a no-brainer. They're not geniuses, but what they knew that we didn't know is how those free trade agreements were written. And they were written against the interests of American domestic businesses. So, yeah, what do? You short the American business because you know they're going to go out of business because they can't compete with imported products produced in China. So no, they're not geniuses, not at all. They just had that inside information about what those trade agreements were really about.
So,
and we trusting fools out here. Free trade. Oh yeah, this is great.
So how do you think this affected the educational system?
Pardon me?
How do you think this affected the educational system in this kind of process?
Well, I'm not sure
okay.
What you mean.
Okay,
on
your site you're getting into the Human Resources Development Plan for the United States, and then it gets into the education system.
Okay, I see. Yes, they're turning the schools into a supply chain management system to produce workers, because the new economy is a centrally planned economy, and with corporate control of the resources, that includes America's children, and they have, as part of the enterprise architecture, they've designed a system that basically is a process control system for children that is essentially a supply chain management system. And they are turning the schools into vocational systems, and everything that a child learns will be recorded on their permanent cradle-to-grave record that will be integrated with their work history record So you basically end up with a full pedigree on a child that, you know, starts school, you know, now. By the time, you know, he dies, there will be a full record of his entire history.
Where does the student information management system come into this?
Well, that's a part of it. The student information management systems are...
I didn't realize that that's what it meant, though, because my grandkids would get these Sims computer programs, and I didn't realize that that was tied in some way, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and if you look at a child as an asset of the corporation, and they're in the incubator for workers, you know, just like chicks are in an incubator. Well, the school is an incubator for a worker, and student information system will have all of the information. They'd actually like to have even the prenatal records of a worker in the student information system. And you know the parents as teachers group? That's basically what their function will be, is to go into the homes of people to document the pre-school development of the incubating worker. And the student information system will be integrated with the workforce development system. And together, the Secretary of Labor will be able to use this system as kind of a trade management system, so that they can determine how many imported workers can they import and still employ the qualified native domestic workers. See, because under the global system, there are no nations, there are no borders, everything is virtual. And so an employer will be able to use the job search engines, or the worker search engines, to find the most qualified person around the entire world. So if you have a average student, their chances in life are not going to be very good, because they're no longer just competing with the kids in their town. They're not just competing with the kids in their state. They're competing with all of the kids their age throughout the entire world. And that's the way the system is being set up.
So then I went into your site here when you're the Silent War. Okay, and you get a little bit further in some of the aspects of what you're talking about in the war.
Silent War is, I didn't write that. That was written by, I think, William Cooper.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a document that he found, I guess. He said he found it in a photocopier or something. I forget what the story is.
Okay, but it's, no, but it's a whole section on your...
Oh, on my okay, the Silent War on my website.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and it's along the same line of the other one, but it was what I was documenting as the Stealth War, and the several things that I listed there were the economy. Because the economy is a stealth war. We have information warfare, and that goes to what I was saying before, you know, where the mainstream media just simply doesn't cover the real news. Everything that they tell you on the mainstream news is either propaganda, or they're framing an issue in a way that they want you to think. Okay, and we also have psychological warfare. There's a lot of psychological warfare, especially on the internet. And then the technological war. And part of the technological war was those electronic voting machines. And they thought that they were going to be able to implement those electronic voting machines, computerized voting systems. And, of course, had they been able to do that, they would have been able to control the election's outcomes forever.
I don't think they've gotten away from it. When I talked to Bev Harris recently in an interview, which I'll probably be playing here in the next week or so, it sounds to me like it's still, you know, it's still going to go. And that it, the persons that designed the software and that sort, you know, are, you know, right out of the prison system numerous times.
Yeah, great. Yeah, cheap labor out of prison.
No, these guys actually came from a computer background, but they've been convicted of crimes for related to that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So, and
well,
the name doesn't come to me right at the moment, but...
There was a time, you know, when you used to have to be bonded to do systems like that, or... But, I don't know, I've written about it. I mean, that was one of my very earliest of battlefronts, is trying to explain to people that a computerized voting system can't ever be secure. You know, just forget about it. It's, you know, you need to have a piece of paper that you can check. The computer can produce the paper for you, and that would be fabulous. That would be wonderful. But you need a paper ballot that you can check and say, and see where it says, yes, I voted on, you know, for this and this and this. And then you take that piece of paper and you put it in the ballot box.
And again, when you're trying to have our form of government, there's another warfare or control mechanism is in controlling the elections. And what I learned from this last election particularly, because I started looking and following those that were digging into the problems with it, is even if they had corrected the computer problems, every trick that has ever been done to throw an election was used. And,
yeah.
And so you don't have to have just, I mean, they had corrupt elections long before computers came along.
Well, that's true, but the computers make it so much easier.
Right. It's much more centralized, and one person can, you don't have to deal with it near as many people. I mean, you know, bringing the cost down of being able to throw election or make
right.
more money
and,
for oneself that way.
Right. And if the, you know, in the old days when there was fraud, you know, like with Lyndon Johnson, and, you know, I guess he had all kinds of dead people voting in his elections. Those situations were rather isolated. And so you couldn't really manage to manipulate a national election. You could do it locally, but you couldn't really manipulate a national election. But with the computerized systems, you can, and very, very easily.
So there's another one here on a coup d'etat that you have on your site.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to get into a little bit of how this may tie in to...
Well, the thinking behind that is that the redesign of our government and the computer systems that are being implemented, that basically constituted an administrative coup d'etat on the American government. I have lots of evidence of things that were done in in the redesign of government that produce fraudulent statistics, and if you have fraudulent statistics, then you, the Congress makes bad decisions, and, you know, they dig the hole deeper because they're working on bad information. And in any large organization that where you need a computer system to manage your process, the administrative process or whatever process it is, when you have somebody messing around with your computer system and they redesign and shuffle everything, basically they can put you out of business. And I do believe that that's really what they did with our government. With this, the redesign of the American government was an administrative coup d'etat.
And what was the reason behind redesigning it?
What was the
their reasoning? What were they giving us for the reasoning that they had to redesign our government?
Well, Clinton, I've seen a few speeches, and he said basically people have been very unhappy with government. And, you know, I when I heard him say that, and I wasn't unhappy, you know, more than normal. I mean, you know, there was always the irritation of, oh, the Democrats are in, and now, you know, we're going to, you know, they're going to do social programs, and then, oh, the Republicans are in, and it's going to be corruption. You know, they're going to do programs to funnel money to their buddies and stuff. But in terms of the structure of the American government, I was never unhappy with it, and I didn't know what he was talking about. And But, you know, at the time when he was giving those speeches, I was totally clueless as to any of this stuff, the trade agreements, the international system, any of the stuff that has been done that led us to this point. I was oblivious to all of it.
Okay, now, there is a place on your website under your new federalism that really does sum up just what I asked you. And it said, between 1993 and 2000, Clinton's reinvented our government, aligning it with the UN system. And I was going through our Colorado statute books just recently on the addendums where they add changes. And I was trying to find what I ran across on a lot, I'd never run across it before, and I just thought it was curious, and I don't know if it had anything to do with this or not, but it kept stating that it was harmonizing, and you keep hearing this term harmonizing, and I see it more often when it means that it's harmonized with the international laws that were set up through, or I don't know if you call them laws, through the UN system.
Well, it's all of the administrative aspects of government, you know, from laws, as you say, but also things like definitions. Do you remember when Bush and Harper and Calderon met up in Montebello, Canada? I think it was Montebello. And they said that all they were doing was talking about jelly beans.
Kinda.
Yeah. Well, what they were actually talking about, well, you know about Codex Alimentarius, right?
Right, right.
Well, what that...
But you might explain that to the public.
Well, I'm not that familiar with it myself, except that what it is it's tables of formulations of products. Medications and vitamins, and I'm not sure all what's on the Codex Alimentarius list, but what they are doing is standardizing the definitions of products globally, so that if you buy an aspirin in the United States, it's the same as buying an aspirin in Africa or you know, if you buy vitamin C here, it's the same if you bought it from China. And so what it is, it's global standardization of definitions and ingredients. And that was what Calderon and Bush and Harper were talking about up in Canada. And when they said that they were just talking about jelly beans, what they were talking about is, are the tables, the definitions of products, and standardizing them so that a jelly bean in the United States means the same thing as it means in Mexico and Canada. And that sounds like a minor thing, but what you're talking about is a manufacturer's production. And one article that I was reading about this standardization had to do with the definition of chocolate. Well, you know, if you're a chocoholic like I am, you know that there are lots of grades of chocolate, you know, from the really cheap stuff clear up to, like, Godiva chocolates. And quality is everything in chocolate. Well, Mexico was a pretty poor country, and so their definition of chocolate, of what comprises chocolate, is different than what our definition of chocolate is. And so, you know, when you standardize something like that, you're talking about a manufacturing process, a grading process, and just the whole production right on down the line. You know, and to redefine those tables is kind of like the tail wagging the dog, you know, because there was no production reason to do it in the United States, no reason whatsoever to do it in the United States. They did it for harmonization to participate in this global trading system.
One of the things that when I did an interview with Joan Vian, and I remember her making the statement that, you know, when the British Commonwealth was kind of broken up, and she was talking among some of these people, these different countries, and whether they voted independently now, and the comment from them was telling her that they still voted, you know, along the lines that, you know, that the Queen wanted them to vote. So when she broke up these Commonwealth, the votes in the UN at that kind of level meant that they had 50-some votes compared to any other country.
Well, yeah, and the same applies to the European Union. Each of the countries in the European Union still has their separate vote in the UN, but the EU, the European Commission, also has votes. So they increase their number of votes by establishing that trading bloc.
So that's kind of like another division of votes on another level that actually, it seems to be like it's these free trade agreements are the ones that are going to be the ones that actually rule what's going on in these countries.
Well, yes, because the systems designers, the global systems designers, are pushing down mandates that we are to change the way that we live in order to accommodate their computer system design.
Okay, and when we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, and then I was trying to find where we got into these free trade, you say tax-free zones, but I thought they were free FTZs.
Foreign trade zones. FTZs are foreign trade zones. Those actually were established sometime in the late 30s or 1940s, but they were never used it was kind of like a landmine that was put in the law that was really never exercised. And that just shows you, you know, how far back these globalists have planned, you know, for what they're doing in our country. It goes over decades. And so those, you know, foreign trade zones and the area, you know, where the Kelo case took place.
Mm-hmm.
Pfizer has a foreign trade zone. They were granted a foreign trade zone in that area. And I never did see that mentioned as part of the case that went to the Supreme Court. But I bet the backroom discussions, you know, or maybe somewhere in the briefs, it was mentioned that that was a foreign trade zone.
And the purpose behind those foreign trade zones are what? Or what do they do to our normal, if as if they didn't exist? What is it that they change?
It's kind of like it's like an offshore island onshore. It's a separate area that's not attached to the United States in terms of our laws, but even though it still is within the continental United States, it's basically plucked out and considered like a foreign country with in and of itself.
You know, the best analogy that I can think of it is when I lived in Texas and they used to have areas that were, I mean, it would be dry everywhere and around, but then they would have areas where they could sell alcohol or drink, and at those places people would have to drive a long ways just to go there so they could buy things that they couldn't buy normally elsewhere.
Yes, it's exactly like that. It's like an exemption. They're given an exemption to the laws of the surrounding area. And so they get special tax preferences. They are exempt from wage and, you know, wage and benefits laws. Just, you know, they're basically like a foreign country unto itself.
And so ultimately, in a kind of in a sense, it's almost like handing a monopoly to somebody or giving them a definite advantage over the rest of the other would-be competing businesses of this sort.
Yes. Anytime you have a separately zoned area that has preferential tax treatment, it's a way of giving a preference to the businesses that are inside the zone, and you know darn good and well that they're going to, whatever businesses that are inside the zone, they are going to be able to put the businesses, the similar businesses around them, out of business because you have an unequal playing field. You've created a system of preference for that one business, and so everybody else can't compete.
Another thing that was brought up when I did that interview with Joan Bion, she'd brought up the fact that there's something like 5,000 different organizations out there that are carrying out various aspects of this war,
mm-hmm.
and anywhere from think tanks that are writing our laws, where we have, you know, congressmen and the sort that don't even read them before they vote on them, to in other words, that when you got that many out there that are meeting and working against our form of government, now some of them will work under the pretext that they are working for it, but often we're finding out that they're kind of fronts.
Yeah. Well, it's not clear, you know, how I would be surprised if there's only 5,000 because it seems like, you know, we're just being swarmed, you know, and they're coming at us from all directions, you know. They're coming after our water. They're coming after our land, coming after our houses. They're, you know, they've attacked our economy and you know, now they want to implement all this, you know, smart technology. I mean, it just goes on and on, you know, the ways that we are being, our way of life is under attack. But it's not clear, you know, how many of them really understand, beyond the boundaries of what their little function is in the world. It's not clear how many of them see what their purpose is in the big picture.
Well, that's one of the kind of the interesting parts about what I keep running into is a lot of people aren't into the big picture. They have a tendency to focus on various aspects, and then when you get bombarded with I mean, right now, just we've got the economy and this G20 going on, which to me is probably the most significant thing taking place, because what they're fixing to do is put in a one world banking system.
Yeah.
Run by the very guys that just gutted ours.
Yes.
And that aren't being held accountable. And yet at the same time, that is going on in the distance, and yet you're hearing all the arguments bannered back and forth over the healthcare system and the other one that's it's huge right now, and my mind just went blank. Yeah, it'll come to me. But we find that I really have to start paying attention to, if I'm hearing all this media attention on to look here, look here, look here, I start having to remind myself, you better start looking, what's missing? What am I not hearing about? And that's when you start looking to go in another area that, to pay attention to.
Right. Well, you know, in order to be able to fit all of this, all of these things together, to understand how they all fit together, you have to have something that provides the intellectual link between them. Like, you know, some people might only be focused on the healthcare reform, and, you know, they wouldn't see the connection with necessarily the NAFTA superhighway. That they, you know, because it's, they have nothing to connect the superhighway to the healthcare reform, and nothing to connect that with the real ID. And so the advantage that I have is that because it was my business to look at computer systems, and I started out looking at the computer systems, and as I did my research, Every time I found a new system, it was a piece of the puzzle for me, and so I have a picture of the enterprise architecture. And so, because I know how all the technology fits, and I know how big systems are designed, and this is not just a big system, this is like the blue whale of systems. And but still, though, it gives me the connecting pieces so that I can make a big picture out of it. And that's why I do these radio programs, is so that I can hopefully explain to people so that they see the big picture and how it all connects together.
And you are on Tuesdays and Thursdays on Oracle Broadcasting with Will Roberts.
Will Roberts. We do a program on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it starts at 9 o'clock Central Time, I believe. It's 8 o'clock my time, Mountain Time. So it's 9 o'clock Central Time for 2 hours, and that's what we talk about is we've been going through all of the things that I've written and how all these pieces fit together and, you know, what comprises the federal enterprise architecture and to some extent how this fits into the global.
Well, what's really fun about your program and by just by knowing the background of between, you know, your background coming from computers and looking at the aspects of looking into, you know, maybe the, I'm trying to say the term I want when you have the board of directors are going through and you can start analyzing who's on a board and where they came from and where they've been and that sort of thing. And how that all ties in, and yet at the same time with Will, he has such a phenomenal background in reading just about anything.
I know. I love Will because he knows all of the history. He's even said, you know, he says his history, his reading, his expertise starts or ends at about 1950, somewhere around there, 1960. And he's got history that goes back to the 1800s. And it was so interesting the other day when we were doing a program. I mentioned something about company towns. You know, at the turn of the century, we had company towns and basically the union movement got rid of the company towns because when you worked for a company town, they owned you.
And that is very prevalent in other countries right now, correct?
Yeah, especially China. But Will knew the history of that. It started in Scotland, I think it was, and he went through this whole history and he described exactly what they did and what they are planning to do in this country. They're planning on going back to that kind of a system, and that's what the foreign trade zones are about.
Right,
you'll end up with a system where you have a company town.
And he does have such a grasp of history and being able to recall it is just really makes it quite interesting. So
yeah, it does.
When you brought up NAFTA Superhighway here, and I just ran across something in an article somewhere about corridors that they passed some kind of animal corridor. Oh, it was a different save the animal corridors or something.
Oh,
healthy animal corridors.
That's in Kansas. They just implemented passed a resolution recognizing an animal corridor, and I really don't know yet what the implications are of that.
Well, I wonder if I'm sure it's got to be their answer to wildlife corridors that they have more in the western part of the country.
I'm not sure because there's going to be research labs there, and so it may be that by designating it a corridor, they get by all of the state laws that would be in place to protect other animals. I know that hoof and mouth disease. State law probably says, you know, if you have any animals that have hoof and mouth disease, they're going to come in and shoot those animals and burn them and bury them. Well, if they move a research laboratory there, the one that was at Plum Island, then they'll have animals that have hoof and mouth disease in that corridor. And so that's kind of what I suspect. I don't know that for a fact, but that's kind of what I would suspect.
Well, I was trying my darndest to try to figure out why they, you know, their reasoning behind them. And because, I mean, what we're seeing with the people with the Trans-Texas Corridor is amazing in its own right. I mean, when you're talking about warfare, that's what those people are having to literally do on a town hall, in any other process they can go through to try to protect their land, because it isn't just about that Trans-Texas Corridor. It's about trying to make toll roads out of all their major thoroughfares.
Right, and that's part of the corporatization of the country. You know, in 1991, when there was a piece of legislation called the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act, and its acronym is ICE-T. in that legislation, it included a clause saying that they were going to relax the rules on toll roads, because when the interstate was built, one of the rules of the interstate was that they were to be freeways, not toll roads. And so in the 1991 legislation, they said they were going to relax the rules, and then in the 1995 legislation, the Highway Designation Act, they declared that the interstate system was complete, and that they would, of course, no longer be building interstates, but that they were redefining the highway system. They came up with the National Highway System, and the National Highway System included not only the interstates, but the arterials and feeder routes to all cities and major transportation hubs.
So it's almost kind of like your watersheds of highways.
Yeah, kind of, yes. They basically federalized the roads leading to the transportation hubs.
And you brought up a story, I think it was on your program with Will, something to the effect, I believe that, I'm pretty sure it was you, that had to do with the bridge there in on the part of the NASCO highway, or is 2B part, am I correct?
Which bridge? The Minnesota Bridge?
Right. The one that collapsed.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't there something to do with the fact of some kind of funding that didn't happen?
Yeah. Just a couple weeks before the bridge, quote, collapsed, unquote, the legislature had, there was a transportation package in front of the Minnesota State Legislature, and it was for something like $5 billion, and the legislature voted no on it. And, son of a gun, a couple weeks later, the bridge collapsed. And the thing about that bridge is that it was not in bad shape, no matter what they said. It was not on the list of bridges needing critical, you know, that needed work critically. So it wasn't a collapse. The bridge was blown, basically. And, so at least that's my opinion, you know, based on
my. Well, you're not the only one out there that, you know, had some questions to do with that, because essentially those highways there in Texas, what the people are fighting in another aspect is Texas does not have a broke highway system down there. They've got plenty of funds to support their highways. They don't need to have toll roads. And yet they've given the concession essentially over to a Spanish company, Sintra. And so now they have somebody, a foreign company now that will be siphoning out the income from this, and it isn't going to be, it will be a sizable toll.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, it isn't, here you have a state that has long distances between towns, and I mean, when I lived there, I know some people traveled quite a ways just to go to work each day, and I don't imagine that it's unusual in other parts of the country, but what they're doing is by raising the cost of people driving, it's going to either force them into the city, out of the rural areas, which it's all very subtle means of getting control of the land.
Yes. Yes, and that's exactly right. And that's war by stealth. And the ultimate goal is to put, you know, for sustainable development, is to pack people into metropolitan areas where public transportation can be provided or they can walk to their job. And so, you know, they want to get people out of the rural areas, and they're doing it by various means. Not only toll roads, but also different ways that they're doing it, like designating heritage areas. That was one thing that they're doing in this valley that I'm living in. These people came in
too.
And wanted to designate the Magic Valley as a heritage area, which is defined as culturally or physically significant. Well, you know, there's nothing really significant about this area except the Snake River Canyon, and nobody is going to do anything with the Snake River Canyon because it's kind of like a smaller version of the Grand Canyon, and it's all lava rock. So, you know, nobody is going to be doing anything with the canyon. So there's really no reason to designate this area as a heritage area other than the fact that what that designation does is that it puts a committee over management of this area. And, I mean, the writing is on the wall. You can see it right now that they will be passing rules, and eventually they'll make this place unlivable.
Where
you can't even, you know, put your trash out on Thursday, you know, whatever.
It's all being done in such subtle means in many of the respects. Some of it's not so subtle, but the fact that incrementalism and done over a period of years that people aren't noticing, well, gee, there used to be a road here. Now you can't seem to get through anymore. Or, they have a reason, well, maybe there's damage to the land or whatever, and some of it will be under, you know, there will be, you know, good reasons initially, but before you know it, there's all kinds of places like that. So the people are being funneled into these large campgrounds or these large parks, as opposed to all the mid-size and smaller ones are shut down because they're no longer efficient. And
right.
And so you can't get out and get away from the crowds, even if you can't afford to pay the tolls that may start cropping up on the roads. And then when they start raising the price of the gasoline, and then they start raising the price of the registration, and they start getting rid of the ability to have affordable cars, and so people have, you know, I mean, there's not that there can't be good reasons behind all of it for, you know, not for, you know, waste and excess and anything of that sort, because I'm thoroughly of that opinion, but when you start realizing that it's about taking our freedoms and taking the ability to own land, which gives us the ability to have a middle class, then that's when we need to start paying attention to this war on the context of everything else.
Yes, and you're so right. And the jobs that I do and that you do and that, you know, other people do, when a piece of legislation comes out and we jump on it and read it to see, you know, where are the landmines? Where are they going to attack us next? I don't think we should have to live this way, where we're basically at war with the people that are writing the legislation coming from Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, what kind of a system is it where a government wages war on its own people? It makes no sense, you know. But just the fact that they are gives a person a hint as to what the future holds.
One of them, when you're talking about war, in this respect, is like just like with water. I was just hearing, and I got to go back in and do some more, you know, research on this. But there are several thousand different fluorides that can be utilized now, which I had no idea there was, or several hundred. One, it doesn't matter that there's just the fact that fluoride can be put in our water and can be of numerous concoctions now, it being a neurotoxin, or the fact that food additives, natural flavorings, there was something to the effect of thousands of them. And
yeah.
And I know people that, you know, they can't even eat anywhere hardly because most of the people don't have a clue of what those things are in some of those foods. And they won't, and you can call them up and ask them and they won't even tell you.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, the corporatization of government, where corporate profit becomes more important than, you know, health and safety. We are disposable commodities to the government. The only thing that matters in this country is the corporate profit.
And that's where when you separated out the government from the corporations, it really gets kind of hard, because when they are allowed to have, in a sense, double set of books with the comprehensive annual financial reports, and have these enterprise zones and that sort of thing, where it's not really taken into the same budget, and yet they're making money, but at the same time coming back to the taxpayer and saying, you know, we need some more money.
Right, and they're using infrastructure that, you know, you had to pay to build that, you know, whatever the park is. The corporate, under the new federalism, which is the system that Clinton and Gore put into place, corporations basically did merge with government. And the way that the free trade agreements, I didn't tell you the whole story on the free trade agreements.
Okay.
The way that those agreements are written, a foreign corporation, if a foreign corporation wants to do business in the United States and U.S. law gets in the way and says, no, you can't do your business that way, what that corporation can do is take the United States to the WTO Kangaroo Court. And if the WTO Kangaroo Court decides in favor of the foreign corporation, the United States can still keep their law, but they have to pay reparations to this foreign corporation for profits that they were not able to earn because they were not able to do business in this country.
I can see that be a slippery slope.
Well, it is. I call it the blackmail government provision, because basically it allows any foreign corporation to blackmail our government. Either let me let me do this business or I'll sue you. And California had pretty tight environmental laws. You know, they had a law against putting this additive in gasoline. I think it was called MTB or something like that. It's a really bad chemical, and they had a law against it. Well, some foreign corporation sued, and California lost in court. And so they had the choice of either paying off this foreign corporation for profits that they weren't getting or getting rid of their law. And so, you know, naturally what they had to do, they couldn't afford to pay this corporation, so they got rid of the law. And that's how it basically empowers corporations and disempowers government. And that's why you're getting nation states that are failing. It's breaking down the nation states and empowering corporations, and that's how you're getting a totalitarian fascist system of government.
Well, I guess we need to come to a close here, and so in summation of war in the context of everything, what do you want to convey to the public then? In
you gotta pay attention, and you've gotta participate, because if you don't participate, we're gonna lose this country and we'll lose the future for America's children. And actually, it's not just America's children, it's for all of the people, the regular people in the world, because the elite that are running this global system, I think they're psychopaths, actually. And the system that they have set up is a psychopathic system, and it's a danger to all of us.
Well, if you got corporations act like a psychopath in the first place. But
yes, they are, because they have one goal and one goal only, and that is to make money. And anything that gets in their way of making money, they're going to take it out, buy it out, destroy it.
And they have no conscience. And when we can transfer that conscience, our conscience, away and let a corporation take over and do what we can, those with morals and a conscience can't compete with it.
No.
And so ultimately, we're going to go down to the lowest common denominator, because if the United States goes, the rest of the world who has any kind of a reasonable living standard will go down to that lowest common denominator.
Yes, and life for the people that do survive, and, you know, we're talking about culling the population and all of that stuff, the people that do survive, I don't think that they're going to consider themselves the winners, you know, when this whole total control system is implemented.
Well, Vicki, I want to thank you for coming on and having this conversation about your work, and your website again is www.channelingreality.com, and your radio program is Become Vocal Local on Oracle Broadcasting with Will Roberts on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and Will's program is actually Monday through Friday at that same time frame of 9 a.m. Central to 11. And again, I want to thank you and say good night.
Thank you for having me, Melody. It's really been an enjoyable conversation.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Do it again.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye.